Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. My name's Daniel, and I'm joined today by the lovely Margarita.
Hello, nice to be back.
Today, we've got the fancy of perception with world-leading cognitive psychologist at the University of California, Irvine, Donald Hoffman. Donald is known for his interface theory of perception, which suggests that instead of presenting reality as it really is, our perception is like a desktop interface that has evolved to ensure survival.
Yes, and Donald is also a regular at our festival. In fact, he's going to be joining us again at Hay this year to debate what the fundamental building blocks of our universe might be, with philosopher Hilary Lawson and theoretical astrophysicist Priya Natarajan.
Donald's also written some great articles for II News as well. If you're interested in learning more about his thoughts and theories, go give his article, Space-Time is Not Fundamental, a read on our website.
Great. Before we hand over to Donald Hoffman, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review on your platform of choice, and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
Modern science and science for the last several centuries has assumed that space and time are fundamental under Newton. And then since Einstein, their combination into the union of space-time. And that is space-time and its objects has been for the last century, and actually for several centuries, the fundamental notion of reality that we've seen and assumed in science. But recently, physicists, high-energy theoretical particle physicists, have discovered that space-time is doomed. It's not fundamental, and they're looking beyond. So Nathan Seiberg at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton says, "I'm almost certain that space and time are illusions. These are primitive notions that will be replaced by something more sophisticated." Ed Witten at the Institute for Advanced Study says space and time may be doomed. Andrew Strominger at Harvard says the notion of space-time is clearly something we're going to have to give up. And Nima Arkani-Hamed at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton says the very notion of space-time is not a fundamental one. Space-time is doomed. There is no such thing as space-time fundamentally in the actual underlying description of the laws of physics. David Gross, winner of the Nobel Prize in physics, says there is no operational meaning to distances smaller than the Planck length. And that's one critical reason why space-time is doomed. It has no operational meaning to distances smaller than the Planck length. And to understand that, suppose that we want to measure something that's very, very tiny. To measure something that's tinier and tinier, we need to use light or radiation with smaller and smaller wavelengths. And that's fine. But as you use smaller and smaller wavelengths, the energy goes up. And if you have unbounded energy, that's no problem. You can go smaller and smaller. But the problem is that when you get Einstein's space-time and gravity involved, then when you get so much energy packed into such a small volume of space, the mass energy density is so high that you create a black hole and you destroy the very object that you're trying to observe. So I'm trying to see some small object. By the time I get down to the Planck scale, the very attempt to see the object destroys the fabric of space-time. So there's no operational meaning to space-time below the Planck scale. It just fails to have any operational meaning. So physicists are looking for a deeper framework. And what this means is that reductionism ultimately is also doomed. Reductionism is the view that as we go to smaller and smaller scales in space, that we find more and more fundamental entities and more fundamental laws that govern the interactions of those entities. And what this is saying is that that process may work for a while, but it falls apart by the time you get to the Planck scale. And the Planck scale is, you know, some people might say that's pretty deep, but it's only 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, 10 to the minus 43 seconds. And it's not 10 to the minus 33 trillion centimeters, just 10 to the minus 33. So in some sense, space-time is a shallow data structure. But so reductionism is also doomed, as Nima Arkani-Hamed puts it, so the entire reductionist paradigm that fundamentally physics is given by some laws at the ultra-most microscopic distance scales, and that somehow we just have to go there to see what's going on, is ultimately false because of gravity. So what's nice about our theory of space-time is that our theory of space-time itself tells us where that theory ends. Our laws tell us the scope and limits of the very concept of space-time. Now, in the standard reductionist view, in some sense, you know, the most elementary particles are the bosons, leptons, and quarks of the standard model of physics. And in that reductionist view, complex combinations of those particles give rise to more macroscopic objects, such as these pyramidal neurons, and they give rise to even more macroscopic objects, such as brains. And then studies of consciousness, for example, then assume a reductionist framework. Most of my colleagues who are studying consciousness will say that the brain and neural networks and their properties and their processing somehow creates our conscious experiences. So it comes, most of the work on consciousness is in a reductionist framework. Global workspace theory, for example, says that there's some kind of working memory that somehow gives rise to consciousness. So working architecture, working memory architecture. Integrated information theory that says if you have the right kind of causal structure of integration of information that you will somehow that is consciousness or creates consciousness. Or the orchestrated collapse of quantum states of neuronal microtubules in Hameroff and Penrose's theories. Or illusionism. So in each of these cases, each theory assumes that particles are fundamental, that particles give rise ultimately to macroscopic objects like brains, and that brains give rise to consciousness or to the illusion of consciousness. So Keith Frankish and Dan Dennett, for example, Michael Graziano might say that we don't really have conscious experiences, we only have the illusion of conscious experiences. And it's real, all that is really real is just the neural activity. Now, so that's, I would say 99% of my colleagues studying consciousness are physicalists of some kind, or functionalists of some kind, as I've just described, or illusionists. But what's remarkable about this work is that if you ask, okay, well, great, so I'm interested in conscious experiences and a scientific theory of conscious experiences. So can you give me the integrated information theory account for the taste of chocolate? What pattern of causal architecture must be the taste of chocolate and couldn't be, you know, the taste of vanilla? Or, you know, what global workspace architecture must be the sound of, you know, a saxophone and couldn't be the sound of a clarinet? Or what orchestrated collapse of neuronal microtubule quantum states must be the smell of a rose and couldn't be the smell of a lemon? And what's remarkable is something that Steven Pinker has pointed out in the case of the global workspace that I call the stipulation problem of consciousness. What Pinker points out in the case of global workspace is that it's a wonderful theory. He likes the theory, but he says the last dollop in the theory, that it subjectively feels like something to be such circuitry, may have to be stipulated as a fact about reality where explanation stops. And this is true of all the theories. There's not a single physicalist, functionalist, or illusionist theory that can explain any one specific conscious experience. We're batting zero. So there's no theory that can give us one conscious experience as coming out and being explained by the theories. And that's quite remarkable. So every experience has to be stipulated, and we have millions and millions of experiences. So that's millions of stipulations that are required. So we have the assumption of space and time and physical properties of neurons and so forth. And then we have to stipulate the conscious experiences as well, or stipulate the illusion of conscious experiences. And the illusionists also have to explain the illusion. Why is this pattern of brain activity, the illusion of chocolate, and couldn't be the illusion of vanilla. So they don't get off easy on this one either. So space-time is doomed, reductionism is doomed, and the physicists, though, aren't, you know, throwing in the towel and saying, oh, oy vey, we can't do this. No, this is, you know, the new generation is quite happy. Let's go beyond space-time. Let's look at physics beyond space-time, and also physics beyond quantum theory. So as for example, Nima Arkani-Hamed says, so there's some other structure that we're looking for, and some way of thinking about interpreting this structure that will let us see space-time and quantum mechanics emerge simultaneously and joined at the hip. So this is sort of the project in high-energy theoretical particle physics for many researchers, is space-time has been a good framework, but it's over. So space-time and its objects are not fundamental reality. It was a useful framework, but it's over. And now we're looking for something beyond space-time and quantum mechanics that will give rise to space-time and quantum mechanics. And we're looking for structures and ideas that don't look like anything having to do with particles propagating in space-time and wave functions evolving in Hilbert space. Again, space and time and quantum theory are not fundamental. And what they're doing is they're looking at trying to explain data from particle scattering experiments at colliders, like the Large Hadron Collider, and like when you might have two gluons smashing into each other and four gluons spraying out. They're trying to get new physics beyond space-time that will explain these particle scattering events. So until recently, this has only been done with quantum field theory. But with the new approach that goes beyond space-time, just in the last 10 years, they've discovered structures entirely beyond space-time, something, for example, called the amplituhedron and cosmological polytopes. And these are structures not curled up inside space-time, but entirely beyond space-time. And behind these structures, one of the deepest structures they've found are something called decorated permutations, literally like permutations are like shuffling cards, shuffling their order. And so these decorated permutations, in many cases, capture all of the information you need to give the probabilities of various particle interactions, scattering amplitudes, and in fact can make them simple. Make two gluon, four gluon out, the example that I mentioned, if you do it inside space-time, you get hundreds of pages of algebra, and it's very, very complicated to compute. When you do it with these new techniques completely outside of space-time, it's three or four terms that you can compute by hand. It's much, much simpler. So what the physicists are saying is, behind space-time, there are deeper structures utterly outside of space-time, such as the amplituhedron, cosmological polytopes, and so forth. And for some reason, there, even behind these structures, there's things called decorated permutations that somehow seem to be governing what we call physical interactions of particles in space-time. So we're at an interesting juncture in science where just in the last 10 years, physicists have really found new structures, geometric objects beyond space-time, and they seem significant, but they're much like the obelisks in 2001, A Space Odyssey, where the monkeys were pounding on them and yelling at them and screaming at the obelisks. And they knew they were very important, but it was not clear what they were trying to tell us. And we're sort of in that situation now. We've just in the last 10 years discovered, the high-energy theoretical particle physicists have discovered these structures beyond space-time. But what are they telling us? What is the nature of this realm beyond space-time? All we have are these obelisks, and they're pregnant with meaning. We don't know what they mean. Right, so behind the structures are these, there's something. So I'm going to now look at consciousness, right? All of the work that's being done right now on consciousness, most of the work, is assuming that space and time is fundamental and that somehow neural activity or complex AIs somehow give rise to consciousness. But that framework doesn't take into account the fact that space-time is not fundamental and reductionism is doomed. So how are we going to have a theory of consciousness that does align with the new developments in physics? So I and my collaborators are working on a theory of conscious agents where conscious agents are like a social network of conscious agents entirely outside of space-time. And then we have to figure out how space-time arises. So we imagine that a conscious agent, so it's a technical term, conscious agent has a set of experiences that it can have. Maybe it experiences red, green, and blue. And then it can decide what actions it might take, which then work on a whole social network of conscious agents. And that network can then in turn, can change the experiences of the single conscious agent. So think of it like the Twitterverse. It's a network of conscious agents like the Twitterverse. And just like I can tweet and follow, I can send out conscious experiences and receive experiences from others. So think of, that's the way to, one way to think about it. Now, there's lots that a theory of consciousness must explain, but what we're doing, as you can see, is only looking at experiences and probabilistic relationships among experiences. If you wanted to have a theory of learning, memory, the self, intelligence, problem solving, and so forth, that will have to come as a construction from the network of conscious agents. And that turns out to be okay, because the network of conscious agents can be proven to be computationally universal. So anything that you can compute with a neural network, you can compute with a network of conscious agents. In some recent work that we've done, we're trying to connect with physics, right? Where the physicists have told us that behind space-time, there are decorated permutations. And those decorated permutations can be used to actually compute scattering amplitudes of particles inside space-time. So we asked ourselves, can we project our Markovian dynamics? It turns out it's a Markov dynamics of conscious agents onto decorated permutations. And in January, we published a paper in which we show exactly how to take any Markovian dynamics and project it onto decorated permutations. So we now have a map from conscious agent dynamics outside of space-time into decorated permutations. And then the physicists can take the decorated permutations and map them into space-time and give us interactions of particles inside space-time. So we start with conscious agents. We use something called trace chains to map them into decorated permutations, and then ultimately into space-time. So what we're trying to do now is to use the maps that the physicists have found from decorated permutations into space-time to make the whole mapping from consciousness into particle properties like mass, momentum, position, spin, charge, and so forth. And our idea is to do a computational test of our theory. So looking at protons, but what are protons and their contents? Well, you know, we all know about matter, you know, like a guy surfing a wave. It's made of molecules. The water is made of molecules, for example, which are made of atoms. And atoms are made of nucleus and electrons. And the nucleus is made of protons and neutrons. And then neutrons and protons are made of quarks. In the case of the proton, it's two up quarks and one down quark, and they're held together by gluons. And so the idea then is that we want to show that we can actually look at the data that particle physicists have found for the momentum distributions of the quarks and gluons inside of protons, and show that our theory of consciousness outside of space-time can actually give us that projection into space-time and get exactly the right momentum distributions. So that if we could do that, that would show that there's a reality beyond the space-time reality that we think about as the fundamental reality. And that is the reality behind space-time. So what the physicists have found is that at the lowest resolution inside the proton, you see three valence quarks, two up quarks and a down quark with gluons connecting them. Now that's the dominant thing that you see. But at a little higher resolution in space and time, you get what's called a quark sea with lots of gluons as well. And then finally, at the highest resolutions they've been able to look at, you get a gluon sea with some quark antiquark pairs popping out. And so what we want to do is to show that a theory of conscious agents beyond space time can match these momentum distributions. I've talked about them informally. These are exactly the kinds of data that physicists have come up with over the last 30, 40 years of doing these kinds of experiments where they, you know, throw, for example, electrons at protons and see what comes out. So we've published this in our paper, Fusions of Consciousness, if people want to look at it. You can say that one Markovian kernel is less than another if it's a trace of it. So if one kernel is a trace chain of another kernel, it's actually a less than it. And that gives you a partial order on these trace chains. And this gives us a notion that there could be consciousnesses of arbitrary complexity, but we can take different perspectives. A trace chain is a perspective. And so this ties into something that Hillary's talked about the open world, but the closures we put on it. Each trace chain is a specific closure on a bigger amorphous consciousness. So that we actually have this idea of closure on a big open space with some kind of mathematical precision. But locally, if you look at any particular Markovian kernel, all the kernels that are less than it, you get a locally Boolean logic. But globally, it's non-Boolean, but locally, it's Boolean. So just to say in sum, in the fantasy of reality, what we're saying is that physics and science for the last few centuries has been assuming that space-time and objects inside space-time is fundamental reality. And what we're saying is that now the high-energy particle, theoretical particle physicists have discovered that that isn't correct, that space-time ceases to have any operational meaning at the Planck scale, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. And they're actually now, in the last 10 years, discovering new structures entirely outside of space-time. Again, not curled up inside space-time, but entirely outside of space-time. And what we're doing now is we're saying, so we can't then try to boot up consciousness from inside space-time, because space-time itself is not fundamental. And the particles inside space-time are not fundamental. They're a projection of a much deeper reality. So the reason why we haven't been able to boot up a theory of consciousness, starting with physical objects inside space-time, like brains, is because we're not dealing with the fundamental reality that we need to deal with. Objects in space-time are not fundamental. And I will just mention in passing that the work that we've done on evolution by natural selection agrees with what the physicists are saying. When you look at evolutionary game theory and you ask the question, what is the chance that organisms have sensory systems that were shaped by evolution to show us truths about objective reality? So what is the chance that we were shaped to see the truth, any truth about objective reality? And the answer is precisely zero. Darwin's theory, as it's spelled out in evolutionary game theory, is very, very clear. The probability that any of our perceptions were shaped to see any aspect of reality is precisely zero. So that again says space and time are not fundamental. They're just a form of our perception. They're a way for us to live long enough to pass on our genes to the next generation from a Darwinian point of view. So think of space-time then. We tend to think of space-time as the fundamental reality, but instead think of space-time as just a headset. It's just a virtual reality headset that we have. And it allows us to interact with this vast network of interacting conscious agents.
Thanks for listening to Philosophy for Our Times. We now have an email, and it's been great to hear from all of you. So make sure to get in contact at podcast@ii.tv with any questions for the editorial team or our speakers, and we'll do the best to answer them in next week's episode. Thanks for listening.